Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy who will grant you a mulligan, but then remind you about it the whole ride home. Ask me how I know. Charlie Nance.
Welcome back once again. We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. You know, a week ago, I told you how I felt like my feelings toward the tournament players course at Sawgrass was changing, and changing for the better. At the risk of flip-flopping like a bad politician, I'm back to despising that track. We'll get to that later, though. Top of the list today, to congratulate one of our own, Webb Simpson. You know, it's funny. I tweeted out on Sunday how strange this game of golf is. The morning of the final round of the Wells Fargo Championship at Quail Hollow Club, I watched Webb warm up and then go play in virtual anonymity in his hometown. Just a week later, he was the toast of the professional golfing world, and deservedly so. What a performance. And his wasn't the only one. A big cat who looms large seemed to put it all together this past weekend, and so did Jordan Spieth. We'll put a bow on the TPC and talk a little about what's ahead with Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com and CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf Kyle Porter. However, when a big-time tournament or major passes, my go-to is to speak first with golf historian Peter Kessler. Peter, I gave it the college try. I even mentioned last week, I was so upset last year by what they did to the 12th hole and what a travesty that was that I said, okay, they say they fixed it. I'm going to actually try to appreciate the tournament players course at Sawgrass. I'm going to search for some subtle nuance. Look, there's a difference between a tough course that is naturally and organically tough like Shinnecock or Oakmont, and a course like TPC, and I don't have a better word for this, Peter, perhaps you do, that is contrived to be tough.
Well, it's a complete nonsense. I mean, the problem with that golf course is that it's a Pete Dye golf course. And in my view, Robert Trent Jones Sr. and Pete Dye have done more to hurt golf in the last 50 years of the 20th century than any damage prior and any damage post. The number of Pete Dye courses that are fun to play are basically none. To me, that's the most important thing when I play a round of golf anywhere is, did I come off the last hole and say, what a fun day that was? That's the key thing. It's not, you know, the routing. It's not anything else. It's all of those things meld together for you to form a conclusion, which is, this was really fun. And when Pete Dye first built the golf course in 1981, before the first Players' Championship was held there in 82, before he started playing with it, it was actually fun. It was very tough, but it was very linksy, and it wasn't manicured, and you could play wall-to-wall like you could at Augusta National till they put the rough in. And then, of course, they started to add rough, and they started to narrow the golf course and try to go for crazy speeds on the greens. And the problem with that golf course is it doesn't really let you play your game. I mean, if you look at the history of winners who have won on that golf course since 1982, it's the least attractive roll call of players when you add in the four major championships. You look at the roster of players who have won the Players, and it's not nearly as attractive, even given its shorter life, as any of the four major championships, because like Shinnecock, the other championships, and of course you've got the Masters, but where the other championships, you know, where the championships move around, are some of the greatest golf courses in the world. And the Players course is not one of the great golf courses, and so you get curious winners. You know, I was just thinking about, you know, how things, you know, stacked up at the end of the day on Sunday, and, you know, you had Webb Simpson, who was not going to make you think of a walk through history, and then Charles Schwartzel, who hasn't played good in ages, and then Xander Schauffele, who's a good young player, Jimmy Walker, who's a decent player. I mean, you go down the list, Jason Duffner, Keegan Bradley, Danny Lee. It's like, who are these guys? And the answer is, they're the guys who could put the ball in play, who hit it shorter so they could play their normal game. I mean, Webb Simpson was number one in driving accuracy and last in driving distance. So it's a put-it-in-play course, and that generally doesn't suit the best players in the world. It's an uncomfortable, claustrophobic, confining golf course as a player, and secretly the guys don't like it.
Well, you know, you mentioned dyke courses that you come off saying you enjoyed playing, and I've played several. I believe the Ocean Course at Kiawah is one of Dante's concentric circles of hell. I never want any part of playing that thing. The one that I give him a pass on, but he can't take complete credit for, is I really, really enjoy and appreciate, and it's beautiful, and I always have fun when I play at Harbortown, but that's Die with Jack.
That's right. You know, it's interesting because when you think of Jack Nicklaus as a golf course designer, nothing really comes to mind in terms of a list of your favorite Jack Nicklaus courses, because the one that he's best known for and is his best course is Muirfield Village. But it was really Desmond Tolhurst that did all of the work, and Jack was just sort of there as a sidekick to learn. You know, this was in the mid-70s, just a few years after he worked with Pete Dye to create the course that they did at Harbortown. And so, you know, Jack was really an apprentice in 68 when that course was being built, and then in the early 70s when Muirfield Village was being built. And then I defy you to think of the name, basically, of another Jack Nicklaus golf course, or a comment from a friend who said, oh, I just played the greatest Jack Nicklaus course. I mean, you know, the greatest players in history have generally been the least successful in terms of critical opinion of a golf course, designers of golf courses. Just because you can play them doesn't mean you can design them. You know, and Crenshaw, who plays sidekick to Bill Coore, which is why it's called Coore and Crenshaw, not Crenshaw and Coore, is Crenshaw realizes he's Bobby Jones to Bill Coore's Alistair McKenzie, you know, the way Augusta National was built, that he's there to give sensibilities from a player's point of view and to contribute what he could. But Coore is the architect. Coore makes the plans. Coore does the design. Crenshaw does the input. Jack did some modest input, in my view, on both courses. And I think because the first one was a collaboration at Harbortown, they did end up with a modified version of what Pete Dye would have built had he been on his own. I think they agreed to collectively be conservative in the building of the golf course, not go for heroic carries, not go for penal shots, but rather a straightforward tree-lined golf course that's completely different than anything either of them were ever involved in subsequently.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Don't know if I want to talk about Webb Simpson just individually, other than the fact that, you know, the magic number was a 7-shot lead going in. No one had ever blown a 7-shot lead in any tournament after 54 holes. And I do believe it's very difficult to play with that big a lead and maintain your focus. I don't think that gets enough play. So I thought it was a great win by him. But I want to talk about something that is sort of unique to him, and that is, Peter, if the USGA and the RNA had a private moment, do you think they would put the toothpaste back in the tube and take a mulligan and not ban the anchored putter, or do you think they would do it again?
It's a very close call because not that many people were negatively affected by the decision. I mean, Keegan Bradley certainly, and Adam Scott certainly, and Webb Simpson certainly, now Bernhard Langer and Scott McCarron have figured out a way to do exactly what they were doing before, because the rule is actually poorly written as to anchoring. You're allowed to have a long putter, you just can't rest your hand against your chest as you swing it like a pendulum. But Langer does touch his chest. McCarron does touch his chest. But intent has to be proved. The act isn't enough. You have to have the intent to touch, and both have said, I don't have the intent, So the PGA Tour and the USGA have said, oh, well, then that's absolutely fine. So you've got a poorly written rule that would really let anybody who wants to anchor, anchor, because it really does come down to intent as opposed to what did actually happen. But I don't think that many guys were negatively affected. I didn't particularly like the way that it looked. I don't know anybody that I play golf with or see play golf where I do. I don't remember anybody in the last 20 years with a long putter. Not really, not anybody. So I don't think it was that big of a popular item. I think it did help a number of guys that we know on the pro tours, but it's a small number. You know, you're talking about a small single digit percentage of the players, and so I don't think they would. I think in a do over they would do the same thing.
Peter, on Saturday and Sunday, for the first time in this comeback, my God, Tiger Woods, for long extended periods of time, looked and played and acted like Tiger Woods. And then something happened on Sunday, and this I was really looking forward to talking with you because of your perspective in history. When he teed it up on the 14th tee on Sunday, he's four back. This is the hole that is his nemesis on the golf course. Even when he won in 2013, he pull-hooked it into the water and took bogey. He proceeded to lace it 364 down the middle of the fairway, almost ran out of fairway in the middle of the fairway. Bones McKay is on the call. He says, this is stock lob wedge 111. Tiger's going to bounce it to the false front right by the pin. It's going to come to a dead stop. Tiger Woods takes a swing. His body language, his face tells you, oh, I got this one. And then it was as if I was taken back in time to old newsreels. And I'm looking at Ben Hogan, age 47, playing the 17th at Cherry Hills in the 1960 U.S. Open. When he hits, and as he said till he went to his grave, I hit it perfectly. The shot I wanted to hit. And it came up short and it spun back into the water. We watched Tiger Woods come up about a yard short of where he wanted to land it, and it spun back down the false front, down to the base, and he wound up making bogey. And I thought to myself, is this the moment when mortality has truly set in, when Tiger Woods' will over the golf ball no longer exists like we once saw it, even when he's playing great?
I don't feel that way. When Ben Hogan, in 1960 at the U.S. Open at Cherry Hills, playing along with Jack Nicklaus in what was still the double Saturday rounds, he hit the first 34 greens in regulation and made no birdies. He putted atrociously and came to the 35th hole of the day, the 71st of the championship. It's a par 5, and with two decent shots, you hit a short pitch over a little pond to what was in that case a front pin. And Hogan always claimed that he landed it on the green and it spun back into the water. And Jack Nicklaus made it completely clear to me. He said, no such thing ever happened. He said, I'm standing right there. He said, it was just a bad shot. And he said, and it didn't come close to carrying the water. He said, it went in the water, never touched the bank. There was no spin back. There was no nothing. And so when I think of Tiger, though, to me it's a completely different situation. Because 1960 at Cherry Hills, that was Hogan's last hurrah. You know, he ended up making bogey on that hole, and he made a triple bogey on the final hole, and he ended up tied for ninth when he had a chance to win with a few holes to play. And that was basically the end of Hogan, other than a couple of, you know, flashy days, the 1967 Masters, right, having a beautiful round of golf. But that was the end of his career. I don't think that Tiger is at the end of his career. I think he's in process. I think that what happened both on Saturday when he didn't finish the round and on Sunday when he went when he finished over par for the last several holes, that I think that what's happening is this is the next step. So he ends up with his not very good golf game making the cut, luckily, on the number, and then shoots the nice 65 on the Saturday, which could have easily been a few shots lower. And I think that he's starting to feel his powers again, his Superman powers, and that just towards the end of the round now, when he's really got it going, little wavering of confidence, a lack of having been in that position for a while, where if he could just keep pressing forward, then he could actually put himself somewhere other than the very outer periphery of contention, but truly in the heart of it. And I think he knew that. I think he's still learning how to do that again. And I think that, you know, when we look at the first dozen holes on the Saturday and the first 13 holes on the Sunday, you know, we realize that he can do all of the things that he was once able to do. And he was the best iron player in the game, and it doesn't look like he's lost a lot on his irons. But his pitching clubs down the stretch, you know, really let him down. You know, the same thing on 17, you're hitting a pitching club. That 17th green is a lot bigger than it looks on TV, and there's plenty of room to land your ball in the middle. And so I just think it's a little bit of lack of confidence, not quite sure of myself with the few holes to play, even though I did Tiger-esque things to this point. And I truly believe that this is just one of the last steps that has to happen before he starts winning tournaments again and perhaps major championships. And the two things are that he needs to feel less pressure on Thursdays and Fridays. I noticed in the 2000s after, like, say, 08, that he started pressing a lot right away on Thursdays and making early bogeys in major championships. And, you know, and he just, you know, scraped by getting to the cut. So he needs to play better on Thursday and Friday. And then on crunch time on Saturday and Sunday, if he finds himself in the thick of things, he needs to refine the confidence that he used to have that enabled him to close at the height of his powers. I think it's just another step in the evolution, which stuns me that I even think this. A year ago, it didn't look like he'd ever play golf again. Now I'm talking about him winning tournaments and perhaps major championships. Well, I don't like his driver swing. I think he needs to let himself turn away from the ball as he did in his prime, which was he moved an inch off of the ball. Now he's very centered, and if you don't load, it's hard to unload, and he's having trouble with that with his longest club. I think he's going to sort it out. I think he's going to sort out Thursdays and Fridays. I think he's going to figure out how to close. I think none of them are huge issues because he's already evidenced that he can do everything with all 14 of his clubs that he needs to be able to do, just in terms of hitting stock shots and stock putts and stock chips and pitches that it would take for him to be able to sustain a performance over 72 holes.
Peter Kessler, golf historian, our guest Taking Dead Aim. And I'll agree with you on this respect. I saw enough on Saturday and Sunday that I tweeted out. I think he's going to win, not just soon. I think he's going to win his next start in Muirfield Village for this reason. He's a horse for that course, and if there's any place that he has a supreme amount of confidence on, outside of maybe Augusta or Bay Hill, it is that golf course. And it would not surprise me one iota to see Tiger Woods go out and win and then have that on his resume and in his mental Rolodex of confidence heading into Shinnecock Hills.
Oh, I totally agree with that because, you know, as I call this a evolutionary process, I think it's a short-term evolutionary process, as you obviously do, and I think that this is the kind of thing that he can fix quickly. This isn't a long-term kind of a deal. So I think clearly he could win next time out. So you certainly got to put the ball in play at Muirfield Village. You know, you can't play out of the rough. You need to put the ball in play on 15 and knock your second shot on the green and two putt for your birdie. There's certain things you need to be able to do there. You've got to get your distance control right on the par threes and leave the ball just under the hole. And you do need to be in play. The angles aren't so important, but in play is critical. So, you know, he's proven he can do it, and if I know he needs to do stuff with his driver's swing, then he knows he needs to do stuff with his driver's swing. So you can be sure he's paying attention to all the things we want him to be paying attention to, but I truly believe exactly what you said to be the case, that there is nothing that would keep him from fixing these things and turning it around promptly and winning his next event.
You may not agree with all that he says, but you have to respect the conviction with which he speaks. It's always a privilege to talk golf with golf historian Peter Kessler. And up next, we check in with CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter, as he takes dead aim at the TPC. Tiger, Phil, and the site of this weekend's Byron Nelson Trinity Forest, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And we're joined now by CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter. Kyle, I want to begin with a tweet that you sent out on Saturday morning, and I made note of it at the time. Quote, the number four player in the world is about to shoot a 65 as one of four players featured on the only live streaming golf this morning at the PGA Tour's premier event, and nobody is even paying attention. And the reason, of course, is the other guy who was in the featured was a guy named Tiger Woods. And I bring this up to this point. PGA Tour television contracts are about to start going into renegotiation. Is Tiger's resurgence a good thing or a bad thing in terms of these negotiations? And I say bad in that it's been proven that, you know, he's one wince away from being gone for a very long time. And it's sort of pointing out that Jordan and these other guys, as great as they are, they can't hold and can't draw those eyes like Tiger can.
Well, I think that, and I thought this for a while, and him being injured kind of muddled everything because you didn't know if and when he was ever going to return. But I think in the short term, it's obviously a really good thing because, like you said, the contract renegotiations with different networks and even you look at PGA Tour Live and what the PGA Tour is doing with a place like ESPN and the ESPN Plus and putting their content on there. I mean, I think only a good thing in the short term, but I think what it creates in the long term is probably a little bit more slack in the rope. That's the term that I've kind of used throughout. And I thought we were going to see sort of the unintended consequences of that play out over the next few years. But with Tiger's resurgence, I think we're pushing that farther into the future, farther, you know, for whatever it is, 5, 10, 15 years, whenever Tiger kind of fades away. So in the short term, I'd say it's great. And in the long term, I would say it creates a lot of questions.
I have not seen the numbers, but I imagine they were huge. I know that I watched more PGA Tour Live last week with featured group coverage of Tiger Woods and Jordan Spieth, and especially those two super groups that they put together. I know you probably did too. Did you ever see numbers on that? How amazing were they?
No, the only numbers I saw was that the Players' Championship had the highest ratings. I think it was on Golf Channel since 2013 when Tiger won it, it sounds about right. But I think what's interesting is what the PGA Tour will do, where sometimes they'll make, say, Thursday or whatever the day that Tiger's not playing on PGA Tour Live is free, and then you have to sign up or you have to pay on Friday. And honestly, it's a great business model because you create a situation in which people are like, man, I got to watch Tiger. I got to have it. And I've heard the numbers from, I think his first appearance, or maybe his, yeah, I think his first appearance on PGA Tour Live was at Riviera. And people that I talked to said the numbers were just a joke for how many people signed up. So it's going to be, you know, I don't know how public all that stuff is going to be, but it's going to be pretty interesting if and when it gets talked about and released.
Well, you know, I don't know if you've given this much thought, but we mentioned the contract renegotiations for TV. I never thought I'd mention this on a golf show. But, you know, Vince McMahon may be the guy who's ahead of the curve on all this, and I can really see the PGA Tour forming their own network similar to what he's done with the WWE network. Lord, they own all of the back content from all of these years. Plus, they could do what they're doing with feature groups and charge an annual, you know, subscription fee to watch throughout the day. I mean, it could be huge.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and it sort of feels like we could be heading that way. But I think the difference in golf is the infrastructure it takes to really cover an event, and especially one that's in the United States, it's more complicated than just because it's so big. Like you're covering such a big area,
right?
And so maybe I'm overstating that, but I do feel like with something like golf, it gets a little more complex. And I mean, honestly, right now they've got the PGA Tour is a pretty great setup because you've got, you know, all these different networks paying for the rights to your stuff, and then you're also you're also sort of double charging because you're able to charge people for PGA Tour Live in the mornings when your stuff is not owned. And so you're kind of dipping into both wells there. And I do think you're right. I'm just curious as to how long it takes for that to play out.
Kyle Porter is CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Again, because of the Tiger effect, I really felt like Webb Simpson's performance was stunning. But because of how Tiger played on the weekend and all the ink that got and how Jordan played on the weekend, I feel like his victory was really underplayed. Did you?
Yeah, I did. You know, I was looking at the numbers. I thought what was interesting, he actually gained fewer strokes on the field than Siwoo Kim did in 2017. Now, a lot of that had to do with the double bogey that he made on 18. I think otherwise he would have been ahead. Siwoo. But I mean, it gets like that when you have a blowout winner, and especially somebody who's not a top six or eight name in golf, like Webb, and especially when you've got Tiger shooting a 65, which is his best round of the year, and having one of his better performances. So it was a little bit unfortunate, especially when you saw the crowds that were following Tiger versus what were following Webb, because we got really one of the better performances we've seen all year out of Webb, and kind of a cool just story about him completely turning around his putting and having the number one strokes gained putting week, and he's number, I think, five or six on the PGA Tour all year. And this is somebody who was in the, the mid-180s, the mid-170s over the last couple of years. So just for him to have put in the work on that and clearly to have turned it around, it's a pretty cool redemption story for Webb Simpson.
Look, I don't think this is an overstatement in any way, shape, or form. If you watched him play on Friday, shoot, if you even watched the highlights on Friday, if you take out the 17th hole, the only person in the history of golf that had a better round than Webb Simpson is Bishop Pickering in the rain in Caddyshack. That guy was draining putts from all over the place. And off the green, they were hitting the cup at 60 miles an hour and going in. It was amazing.
Yeah, it reminded me of 2014 when Bubba Watson kind of went crazy at the Masters on a Friday. And as you were watching it, I go back to that round a lot. I can't remember what he shot. I think it was 66 or something like that at Augusta. And as you're watching it, you're like, well, this guy's winning the golf tournament. I mean, it's very clear to me that this is a round that is going to win this person the golf tournament. And if this person loses, it's going to take sort of a historic collapse or just a crazy out of nowhere two rounds on the weekend from somebody else. And that was the feeling you got when you were watching Webb. And, he had a real shot at 60 late, which is insane on that course. Didn't get it, but it's pretty cool to see him have so much success. Especially over those first couple of rounds.
Yeah, look, I never thought I'd hear the words, we're on 59 watch at the Players Championship. Yeah. I didn't think that was possible. Kyle Porter, CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about your boy Phil for a second. Before we get to his fashion, let's talk about his play. What in the hell happened on Friday? That looked like me and you out there.
Yeah, him and Spieth were, it was pretty bad. It was pretty ugly for the featured groups. I don't know. I always take Sawgrass with a grain of salt with him. He's missed five of his last six cuts there, and it still hasn't really affected the rest of his year. I think the thing that's concerning if you're a Phil fan is just kind of his comments after the rounds where he's talking about, and he talked about this at the PGA a little bit last year, but talking about energy and not being able to, be able to put a full week together and part of that is due to age, but part of it is, I feel like he sort of insinuates and raises questions about health issues. And he hasn't come outright and said it. I don't have any information about it, but he sort of alludes to it a lot. And you don't really know whether it's age or if he's, struggling. Who knows? But it is a little bit concerning when he mentions that, I feel like, so often.
Well, and it's concerning when you think about where they're going next to the U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills and the way he's driving the golf ball. It could get ugly in a hurry with the wind blowing at Shinnecock, which leads me to this. Father Time is undefeated in all things. And with each passing year, it becomes harder and harder for Phil to win that career Grand Slam to break through and win the U.S. Open. Now, there's no knocking the guy. He's the second best player of his generation, and it's not even close. He's already in the Hall of Fame. But if he doesn't complete that career Grand Slam, will it be like Sam Snead, like we remember Sam's like, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, he was great, but, or does it matter?
I don't know. I go back and forth on this. Sometimes I think it matters a lot, and other times I think it doesn't matter because it's Phil, and you're not really going to remember anything he did besides that he was crazy and fun and, you know, just how he made you feel, like when he was really in contention. So I think I don't know. I think it does matter. I just don't think it matters maybe as much as we think it does in the moment and you know, as we've thought over these last 10 or 15 years.
Okay, let's get to it. That shirt, though. I mean, I know Phil has a piece of the action, and I get why he's doing it, but all I can think is, okay, how soon is it going to be before some idiot shows up at the golf course that I'm at wearing short pants and the long-sleeved dad shirt?
Well, you saw that Tron Carter of No Laying Up is rocking it at the BMW Pro-Am today on the web.com tour.
No.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Oh, gosh.
So I guess there's your answer.
Oh, Kyle Porter, CBSSports.com, Eye on Golf is our guest taking Dead Aim. Go back to the big cat for a second. I saw enough on the weekend where it was like going back in time, and Tiger Woods was Tiger Woods. He was that guy on the wall, you know, in everybody's posters. That's what it looked like for the better part of 15 years. And I saw enough that I said, you know what? His next stop is Muirfield Village. He is the horse for that course. And Kyle, I really feel like he's going to win the Memorial. Am I crazy and just dreaming on that, or do you think that's a distinct possibility as well?
No, I think it's a possibility. I think that, I mean, I said after the Players that if he drives it like he did on the weekend, he's going to win the U.S. Open. I mean, forget the Memorial. Like, the way he hit it off the tee on the weekend, everybody goes to the 14th hole and won the 354-yard drive there. But for me, it's the shot shape, the way he is kind of rope hooking it on 18, the way he is hitting these two irons off of, like, I mean, he hit a two iron off of 10 on Sunday that was just like, holy crap, like, what was that? And, you know, that's always been his thing. Can he get it into position? I mean, on the weekend, the final two rounds, he gives himself 25 looks at birdie from fewer than 20 feet. So you're just gonna accidentally make 12 birdies.
Yeah.
I mean, you're just going to run into the hole 12 times. And the reason he's doing that, it's all based on the second shot. You know, are you in position off the tee, and then what are you doing with that position? You know, where are you putting your irons? And his iron play has been great all year, but he hasn't been putting himself in position enough off the tee. And when he did that on the weekend, he hits 22 fairways on the weekend, all of a sudden it looks easy. I mean, he said it on both days, which is kind of funny, but kind of true, that 65 and 69 were about as bad as he could have shot on both of those days. And it's true if you watch the way he hit it off the tee. So, yeah, I mean, if he hits it off the tee like that at Muirfield or at Shinnecock, then we could be talking about a multiple winning big cat later in the year.
You know, you brought up the 14th on Sunday, and it was at that moment that something occurred to me. Tiger may be more rootable now than ever because he's more mortal than he's ever been before. And you bring up the 14th. Like you said, he hummed at 354, 364, whatever. Bones is on the call for NBC, says, Johnny, this is stock, 111. He's going to hit lob wedge. It's going to bounce right in front of the false front, hop up, and come to a skidding stop next to the hole. Tiger hits it. His body language says, I got this one. Only his will didn't overcome what the ball did, and he came up just about a yard short of where he wanted to land it, and it spun down the hill. And Tiger Woods, in his prime, that ball never had the audacity to come up short and spin down the hill. And to me, he's almost more rootable now because that kind of thing can happen.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, and to hear the way that he talks about it is even more interesting, because and you saw this with the water ball on 17, he starts talking about the wind and what the wind is doing, and it's like, well, maybe. I mean, there's certainly instances in which that is true, but you might have just mishit it, or you might have just had the wrong club. And so I think that, yeah, it's so interesting, because I think that sometimes we can't come to grips with, he can't come to grips with, that he's not hitting every single shot perfectly like he used to, like he always has. And, yeah, that makes him more human. That makes him more like, I mean, as much like me and you as he's ever
going to get.
And, so, yeah, I think this part of his career, just the aging legend, is it creates the most conflict within the story, and I think conflict within the story is where the drama and the real interest is found.
Get you out of here on this. Kyle Porter is CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, our guest taking Dead Aim. You live in Dallas. I know you're going to be out at Trinity Forest this weekend. You've played it. What are your thoughts on it as the new venue for the Byron Nelson? What have been the players' thoughts on it?
Well, I keep hearing players sort of hesitant to go all in on it, sort of hesitant to praise it, sort of hesitant to just say anything positive about it. And after playing it, I don't understand why that's the case. Is it different? Yes. It is basically the exact opposite of TPC Four Seasons. It's unlike anything that is being played on the PGA Tour, but it's also a fascinating test of not only hitting shots, but decision-making. And it just, you know, the thing that I told my friends after I played it was I could play it 1,000 times and play it 1,000 different ways. And to me, that's interesting. Like watching Jordan Spieth try to figure out how to play this course, trying to, you know, watch Sergio Garcia shape shots both ways, depending on where the wind is and what it's doing. That is interesting to me. And I think the players don't like it because it forces them to do a lot of things that they don't usually do, and it forces them to make decisions, and it forces them to think in ways that they don't normally think, to get uncomfortable, I think is the word that Adam Scott used. But as a consumer of golf, as a fan, as somebody who writes about it, that is what I want to see. Like, you know, and you don't want it to get silly or crazy like the U.S. Open gets sometimes, but from the perspective of that course, I think it creates a ton of opportunity for decision-making and shot shaping, and that's what I want to see from the best players in the world.
To me, he's the best everyman voice covering the game today. CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf, Kyle Porter. And when we return, a past recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, Ron Cyrak from RonCyrak.com, takes Dead Aim at the TPC. And what's ahead? Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. A past recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism, Ron Cyrak is with us.
Let's start with the venue last week, Ron. The tournament players course at Sawgrass. I really went into it this year with an open mind because I was a little disappointed with what they did with the 12th last year, and they said they were going to make some changes. So I was like, okay, this year I'm going to go in. I'm really going to try to appreciate the nuance of TPC Sawgrass. So I gave it the college try, and I just, there's something about it. There's a difference between a tough course that is naturally and organically tough, like Shinnecock or Oakmont, and a course like this one, and I hate to use this word, but I can't think of a better word, it seems contrived to be tough.
Well, it's one of those interesting golf courses where if you're hitting good shots, you can score on it because the par fives are all gettable. It's got a pretty good set of par threes. I'm not a big fan of an island green hole, but I've grown used to it at TPC Sawgrass because, you know, if I have to see it once a year, that's fine. But, you know, to me, a good golf hole, you should have options, and there's no options on number 17. You're either on land or you're not on land. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays now when they move it back to March. It's certainly going to play longer. They certainly have tried to build some excitement into the golf course because number two is an eagle hole. number 11 is a possible eagle hole. They've made 12 a possible eagle hole now, and 16 is way an eagle hole. So they have built some excitement into it. One of my problems with Florida golf courses in general is water becomes your only defense. And I'm not a big fan of water as rough, because the point of rough should be it's a half-stroke penalty. You should have a chance to recover. You hit it in the water, it's just a stroke penalty. There's no chance to recover.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I asked this of John McGinnis last week. I got to thinking, the 18th at the TPC at Sawgrass is not unlike the 18th at Memphis. It's not unlike the 18th at the course that's had the Houston Open for the last 20 years or so. There's huge bodies of water on the left off the tee. I don't think, based on what I see at those three courses, especially at Sawgrass every year, I don't think anything strikes fear in any golfer, left or right-handed, like water up the left side. What is it about that? They're the best golfers in the world. Shouldn't they just be able to bomb it over the top of it?
Yeah, 14 is really, that's one of the toughest driving holes there. You know, there's a stretch there on that front nine, five, six, seven, when I sort of get into, like, the holes. You know, one of the indications of a really good golf course for me is how well I remember every golf hole. And 5, 6, 7 all sort of blur together a little bit for me. The question is, okay, is the water left or right on this hole? Because you know it's out there. I was once playing a Florida course with my friend Doug Ferguson from the Associated Press, and we get to about the 15th hole, and he said, "What do you think of the golf course?" And I said, "You ever see that Gilligan's Island episode where they almost get rescued, but Gilligan screws it up right at the end?" And he thinks, and he said, "That's every episode." And I said, "That's how I feel on this golf course." So.
Ron Cyrak with RonCyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. Why is it, do you think, that since the tournament moved there in 1982, no one has won it more than twice, no one's won it back-to-back, no one has defended the title? And I bring this up because, like Augusta, this is a course, a big-time championship that is held and contested on the same course every year. There are little changes here and there every year, I'm sure. But, you know, it's the same course. Yet in that same period of time at Augusta, you've had all those things accomplished.
Yeah, that is a fascinating thing, and I'm not sure why. You try to figure out what kind of golfer does the course best suit. And it's clearly somebody who puts the ball in the fairway because of all the water reasons that we just talked about. But, you know, one year you have Greg Norman go in there and he shoots, what, 24 under and destroys the golf course. But then can't build on it. And the same thing there. Sergio got a win there 10 years ago. And I can't figure it out except to say, that might be a commentary on the quirky nature of the golf course. That most courses, and Augusta is a great example, there's a route to follow. You figure it out and you follow it, and the courses can be friendly to you and times even benign. But it's almost like there isn't a path around Sawgrass. So it baffles me.
Ron, before we get to Webb Simpson, let's sort of talk about him in a roundabout way. Do you think that the game of golf made a mistake with the banning of the anchored putter? I realize you can't put toothpaste back in the tube, but if the USGA and the RNA got a mulligan on this, do you think it would be a different decision?
I think that they might. I think it was one of the situations where, early on, it looked like the PGA of America was more in touch with the rank and file golfer than the USGA was, because the PGA of America was it initially opposed it. And, and I know talking to the guys at my club, there were several who anchored and it was not something that they wanted to see go away. Look, to me, in the grand scheme of things, of the issues that are impacting scoring in professional golf right now, and we're talking professional golf, not the recreational game, of the issues impacting scoring, I don't think the anchored putter is in the top five. But they chose that to be the issue that they deal with.
You know, we've seen guys win majors and big-time tournaments with a conventional putter and then win it with an anchored putter. But until this week, I don't think I'd seen the converse. Is this being underplayed? Because I think what Webb accomplished last week in this one aspect of the game, and I realize that his putter is not truly conventional. It's not 34, 35 inches long. But still, it's a major switch from what he was doing. I think this was a huge deal.
It was, and it took him a long time to make the adjustment. It was a long time between wins for him, and you know, and some other guys haven't made that adjustment very well. But I do think it was a breakthrough for him. I'm not sure how much it's a breakthrough for people like him. But I do think that Webb's going to be somebody who's this isn't going to be his last victory. I think he's going to pop a couple of more out there for us.
To your point about how Sawgrass caters to one player or another, I think my favorite stat about Webb that came out this last weekend was he was number one in fairways hit, and he was dead last in driving distance.
Yeah, that's the key, you know, is keep your ball out of trouble. You know, it was one of the reasons that that Tiger's had such a spotty record on that golf course is because when he's got the wide rights going, you know, it's a hard place for him to score because you can't do that. So it is a position golf course that way. You know, you got to put your tee ball in play and then try to go at the green there. It's not an overly long golf course, that's for sure. And there are a lot of vulnerable holes if you drive the ball in the fairway.
Ron Cyrak with RonCyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. There was an interesting number that came out going into Sunday. In the history of the PGA Tour, no one had ever blown a 7-shot lead. Now, I could think of several 6-shot leads off the top of my head, but 7 was a magic number. And just as I was about to say, okay, well, this is a done deal, I love what you tweeted out. Billy Casper, 7 down with 9 to play, 66 U.S. Open and 1. Faldo, 6 down going to the last round of 96 and 1. Tiger, 7 down with 7 to play, 2000 AT&T and 1. Inertia is a powerful force. This will be an interesting final round at the Players. And it's because of that, that the way Webb Simpson went about his business, and I don't think anyone ever got closer than 4, it's a lot harder to play with the lead than to be somebody just firing free will from behind. That was a really great win.
Yeah, it really was. It is hard to play with the lead like that. And you know, because you know, when you have a big lead like that, you've got everything to lose and nothing to gain. Everybody expects you to go out and win. And you know, when Tiger pulled within 4 strokes with 6 holes to play, you know, you got to think that made it onto Webb's radar screen that he was noticing, because you know Tiger still had had an eagle hole ahead of him on 16 at that time. And so you know, you would think that he'd be paying attention to that, but to play with the kind of patience and discipline he played with, and he really seemed to be. I mean, his goal for the day seemed put the ball in the middle of the fairway, put the ball in the middle of the green. You know, he didn't go hunting for pins, and he didn't do anything stupid. And it's easy to let a part of what we like to call choking that we underestimate is decision making. You know, it's not all physical. It's not all the bad shots you hit. It's bad decisions that you make, and that's when inertia can play a role in it. When things start to get out of control, it's easy to let your mind get out of control too, and Webb never let that happen on Sunday.
Ron, going into last week, I thought that Jordan Spieth had the most to show me of the great players heading into the stretch for the U.S. Open. He made the cut on the number, and until the 18th on Sunday over the weekend, he looked a hell of a lot like Jordan Spieth. Your thoughts on who needed to show you what, and what do you think heading towards Shinnecock?
Well, you know, I think we're in a situation right now where no one has sort of like raised their head above the crowd and claimed this season. Justin Thomas just takes over the number one ranking in the official world golf ranking. But you know, we've not really seen what we think is the best from Spieth or from Dustin Johnson or from Rory McIlroy. It is going to be interesting to see as we swing into this next major. Who's going to get their game together and get on form. Spieth's putting has baffled me this year. It's always been the strong point of his game, and it's been a little bit up and down. I felt coming into the Players that we had a lot of players playing pretty well. You know, it looked like McIlroy was getting it together, and it'll be interesting to see. Shinnecock is one of those tests where this is going to be another golf course where keeping the ball in play is going to be really important. And if they get a little win there, which they can do, it's about a mile or so from the ocean. It gets to be a really demanding golf course off the tee. You know, I hate to say the nasty word, but I'm going to be curious to see what Tiger Woods has in store for us. You know, he showed us on Saturday that he's capable of 65, But on both Saturday and Sunday, he had trouble closing those rounds out. That 65 on Saturday could have been a 63 or a 62, and the 69 on Sunday should have been a 65 or a 66. And that's odd to see Tiger be in that position where he's having trouble closing rounds out. He was usually the best in the world at that.
Thank you for bringing that up. Ron Cyrak with RonCyrak.com is our guest taking DNA. We've waited long enough to talk about Tiger. On Saturday and Sunday, for extended periods of time, for really the first time in this comeback, Tiger Woods, he was the Tiger Woods. It was on full display. The one thing, and you brought this up, and the word that comes to mind with me is there seems to be a mortality to his game that there never was before. And I bring up, I think this was the moment on Sunday, and it wasn't when he rinsed it on 17. The moment for me on Sunday is he had gotten within four shots of the lead. The 14th hole, which had been his nemesis over the years, even when he won back in 2013, he took double because he pull-hooked it in the water left. He laced a 364-yard bomb down the middle of the fairway. He almost ran out of fairway.
And then misses the green from 111 yards.
Well, and Bones is on the call, and Bones says, this is full lob wedge. He wants to have it bounce once, bounce up by the hole, and come to a grinding halt. And it was as if, you know, Bones had been on the bag for Phil. He'd seen this shot 100 times. He'd been with Tiger. He'd seen this shot 100 times. Tiger hit it. The look on his face was, I got it. I hit it. And it came up just a bit short. He didn't carry it to the hill. He carried it in front of the hill. That first hop went up to the hill and spun backwards down the false front. And, you know, what popped into my head was, where have I seen this before? And this is a long time ago, and it's all black and white. But at 47 years old, on the 17th hole at Cherry Hills in the U.S. Open, Ben Hogan is right there, and Hogan hits when he still maintained to his death, I hit it perfect. And it came up short, and it spun back, and people have talked about that was the moment where Hogan's will no longer, the ball no longer listened to Hogan's will. And I'm wondering, are we at a point with Tiger Woods where, wow, the ball no longer bends to his will?
Yeah, the aura of invincibility is definitely not there. And, you know, the great Dan Jenkins, when we were talking about Tiger, said, and he said, you know, sometimes you just use it all up. And, you know, I'll go back to Bay Hill this year when Tiger hits it out of bounds on 16 when he has a chance to win.
Stunning.
You know? And that's a par five where he didn't even need to hit driver off that tee. He could have hit three wood and had a mid-iron into the green. And you wonder, is that execution or is that decision-making? And the same thing on 14. Man, I remember a few years back on 14, Tiger drove it into the water over the hill to the right. You know? he drove it over that hill into the water. And I didn't even know there was water over there until I went over to see where his ball was. So, that hole has always owned him. And he was in perfect spot there. And you look both days on Sunday, he shoots 30 on the front nine Saturday, 35 on the back nine. And then he shot, 32, 37 on Sunday. And the back, there's a lot of scoring holes on the back nine. It opens up with three birdie holes. 10, 11, and 12 are birdie holes, and 16's a birdie hole. So, you know, you've got, and the position that he put himself in on 14 should have been a birdie hole. So the opportunities were there, and he wasn't able to cash in on them. That's going to be interesting to watch going forward. You know, are there gremlins running around in his mind? I always go back, I know I've talked with you before, I always go back to when Lai Yang beat him in that 2009 PGA Championship. That had a lot to do with shattering the aura of invincibility around Tiger. That was a day when the other guy made all the big shots, not Tiger. And he's not quite been the same closer since then.
Yeah, no, I've always described it as the Buster Douglas moment when he was on the canvas looking for his mouthpiece and somebody else had their arms raised.
Yep, exactly. And you know, that aura of invincibility, too, not only are there questions in Tiger's mind, but all these other young kids that are out there. It's been 10 years since he's won a major now. It's been 5 years since he's won any tournament. They've never seen the real Tiger Woods. They're not afraid of him in the same way that Ernie Els was or Sergio Garcia was or Adam Scott was when he was a young pup. Tiger's Charles Howe III. It's like a whole generation of players in there that Tiger psychologically destroyed. And these kids now out there of Spieth and McIlroy and Justin Thomas and Daniel Berger and John Rahm, you know, they don't have that fear of him.
From earlier this week, always a privilege to talk with Ron Cyrak of RonCyrak.com. Also, I'd like to thank CBSSports.com's Eye on Golf Kyle Porter and golf historian Peter Kessler for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, even for a diehard like me, it's a little dodgy this weekend to get your golf on in the Carolinas. But if you do tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.